Hello and welcome to The Europeans. This is a very, very special episode because it's only the second episode ever that Katie and I are actually in the same room.
In the same room, in the same city, in beautiful Berlin. It's so exciting. And listeners, we have had a lovely weekend. Berlin is so beautiful and autumnal with red and golden leaves all over the place. And I've been walking around in a daze, looking at the trees for 2 days.
And it was Katie's birthday.
It was.
And for her birthday, I took her to the European Commission offices of Germany.
It's so sweet of you. We were invited in for a little chat and we had a little tour of their offices. And I don't know if we're supposed to reveal this, but there's a cupboard in the European Parliament's German offices that it just says gadgets on it. They have a gadget cupboard. It's amazing.
Breaking news. And Katie also came to see my opera. I've managed to find her a ticket.
It was really kind of you to give me 2 hours of terror on my birthday with you just like staring creepily around, being a murderous, creepy doctor in your new show, Usher. I should stress you were really, really amazing. But like, it took me a full 24 hours to not be scared of you anymore. You were terrifying.
It's what I do best.
It really suits you.
Yeah, apparently it does. But a few people in the audience might have been a bit disappointed that Usher or Usher was in fact not the pop star Usher, because the show that I'm in has been wrongly advertised on Viagogo, one of these big ticketing websites, as one of Usher's live tour dates. Tonight we have the second show and I'm expecting there might be a few Usher fans who are a bit confused as to why they're hearing a contemporary opera.
They're going to sit very patiently through the whole thing and then be like, wait a second, is he not coming?
Yeah, or maybe I am like representing the like true soul of Usher through my creepy.
You're a different kind of creepy though. You were just sort of like sitting staring for a lot and then singing about fear and death, which was really lovely. In French, incidentally, which was so weird to hear you singing in French for quite a long period of time. You're very good, though. I thought you were the best one at speaking French.
Thank you. Can I put this on my website as a quote from the Europeans podcast? My first review.
Quite good at speaking French. Anyway, so yes, we've been having a lovely time hanging out in Berlin. Yes, there was a very big anti-Nazi demo, thousands and thousands of people at Alexanderplatz, which was very lovely and heartwarming to see. And apart from that, just been eating kebabs, really, and drinking. It's been great.
And Katie's been complaining that I go home really early because I'm a singer.
You do. I had to like find some other friends to hang out with last night. That's why I'm a little bit croaky.
And that's why I'm not.
Smug.
Anyway, what have we got coming up today?
This week, our guest is the amazing Thana Farouk, who is a Yemeni photographer. She's based in the Netherlands. And Thana has an amazing new exhibition out in New York at the moment about unlucky passports. So people from countries like her own who find their travel severely limited by the piece of paper that they carry around in their pocket. It's a really amazing project. And the fact that Thana can't go to her own exhibition because she couldn't get a visa to go to the US kind of speaks for itself, really. So we have Thana on the line from her home in the Netherlands to talk all about that.
And we're also going to be speaking to a European hip-hop expert, cultural historian Bram Hilkens, later in the show. But first...
It has been a bad week for Danish public finances after it emerged that a civil servant has managed to embezzle 111 million kroner, which is about 15 million euros, like truly crazy amounts of money. The police are looking for a woman who held an admin job in part of the Children and Social Affairs Ministry for more than 40 years. And apparently she was supposed to be this very highly trusted employee. She had really high access to all the ministry's systems. But yeah, over the last 16 years, she was siphoning off cash from this ministry, which is supposed to be helping kids and the most vulnerable people in Denmark. So that really sucks. And it kind of reminded me of a couple of other cases around Europe of people nicking money that's supposed to be going to people in a really bad place. There was that case in Britain recently of that council worker who stole £60,000 meant for survivors of the Grenfell Tower disaster, that horrific fire in the apartment block in London last year. And also in France, and I find this really fascinating and grim, there have been actually several cases of people pretending to be victims of the Bataclan, the terrorist attacks back in 2015, to get compensation, and like going in the media and giving interviews about how traumatic this experience of surviving this attack was when they weren't even here. Just really terrible.
It's not okay.
It's really not okay.
Don't do that, guys.
So that's grim. Do you want to cheer me up with good week?
Yeah, okay. So it's been a good week for donkeys living and working in the Greek island of Santorini.
You just made them really sound like humans there.
Well, we need to treat them more like humans because they are kind of slaves. as one of the animal advocacy groups said, these animals are enslaved. And the Greek government has banned the carrying of heavy things on these donkeys' backs. The law states that they cannot carry more than 220 pounds on the rather grueling journey up the cobbled hills of Santorini in the blazing sun. The law doesn't explicitly refer to the carrying of heavy human beings, but the headlines for this story have all honed in on that consequence. So basically, people who are over 220 pounds can't be lifted by them. The law comes into force partly because of huge international pressure on the Greek government from animal advocacy groups about the bad treatment of poor donkeys, who are one of the preferred methods of transport from the port of Santorini, which is like one of the busiest ports around in the Greek islands. It receives around 700,000 cruise ship visitors each year, many of whom don't fancy walking the 600 steps to the clifftop centre or don't want to queue for the tiny cable car that only fits five people at a time.
I was going to say, isn't there a cable car? Why doesn't everyone take that?
Yeah, there is, but I think there's always a bit of a queue. Or I also think people just want to get on a donkey's back because they think it looks cool.
Fun thing to Instagram.
Yeah, I guess so. I'm all for protecting these enslaved donkeys who are working their asses off. but seriously, like, how is this going to be regulated? Are they going to put like scales next to the donkey collection point? Because that feels a bit body shamey.
It does feel a bit body shamey.
And perhaps they should have just banned all human carrying.
I was going to say that as well. Like, why can't they just not use donkeys?
So what they say is it's actually one of the most practical ways, or one of the only practical ways, of getting large appliances up to the city as well. So they don't just use the donkeys for humans, they also get up like fridges and things.
No way.
On the back of donkeys, which actually sounds really sad, doesn't it?
Did you see that video that went viral a few months ago of this like big robotic spider thing?
No.
Oh, it's really creepy. I'll post it again just for funsies. But yeah, I was thinking maybe they should just make like robot donkeys instead. Eventually, I feel like that will happen.
It probably will. Or they could just install a Stana stair lift.
Yeah.
I don't know if everyone knows what Stana stair lift is. Is that a British thing?
Not sure.
Lifts that old people have to help them go up the stairs.
Quite windy though, this one.
And 600 steps is quite a lot of steps to cover. And maybe a bigger cable car is a better idea.
Might be. But anyway, good week for the donkeys.
Good week for the donkeys. Happy donkeys. Congratulations, donkeys.
After last week's spare noise, shall we end the segment with a donkey noise?
Yes. This podcast is supported by Future Europe, a podcast from the European Investment Bank.
Now, before you say it, the European Investment Bank is not like a really mean, evil investment bank. It is, it's actually part of the EU. It's a non-profit bank which basically lends out money to countries all around Europe for infrastructure projects. They have put together a little podcasting series, one for every EU country, celebrating technical innovation in Europe. So there's one about Sweden going cashless, there's one about lasers in Hungary, there's one about smart cities in Belgium.
Here is a little clip from the episode about Croatia building the fastest ever electric car.
It is 1,914 horsepower. Again, four electric motors. We are controlling each wheel 100 times per second independently. 412 kilometers per hour top speed. The numbers are really crazy. But at the same time, we want to have a very comfortable, very safe road-going car that anybody can use. So it's really pushing the limits in every way. It's really on the edge of what's physically and technologically possible today.
One thing that's really nice about these podcasts is they're super short, only about 7 minutes each, which is a really nice amount of time for doing what, Dominic?
Cleaning the fridge.
That's a very unthorough job, but yeah, sure.
I've got a tiny fridge.
Okay, fair enough.
You can listen to two.
You could.
If the fridge still needs cleaning, then listen to another one.
I feel like if you're going to do a proper job, you should get through all 28, but I'm just fastidious like that.
Yeah, well, that's why you never clean the fridge, because you want to leave enough time to listen to 28 7-minute podcasts.
This is great chat.
Anyway, the series is called Future Europe. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts, and we'll post the link in our show notes. We are now going to be speaking to Thanne Farrokh from The Hague, Den Haag. She is a documentary photographer and storyteller from Yemen, and she has been working on this wonderful project called The Passport, looking at the idea of the unlucky passport and what it's like to have one of these unlucky passports. So she's from Yemen, where the passport is ranked, according to the Passport Power Index, 89th out of 94 that they rank. The other passports that are below Yemen are Somalia, Syria, Pakistan, Iraq, and Afghanistan. We're going to be speaking to her about what it's like to have one of these so-called unlucky passports and what story she's hoping to tell with these photos.
You have some photos on show at the Open Society in New York at the moment, which is about people with unlucky passports. And you can't go to your own exhibition because your visa got denied. Like, I can't think of many things more ironic than that.
It was devastating, to be honest. It was frustrating, but I'm just so glad that my work is showing now, because art crosses boundaries like any other medium. And I feel there is somehow an artistic justice in that sense. The project is my passport in that sense.
I was wondering if you could tell us when in your life you realized that you had a passport that was unlucky.
I was born and raised in Yemen, and I only hold a Yemeni passport. As far as I remember, my passport has been like, it feels literally like a curse. But it became even more frustrating when the war erupted in Yemen. It was the moment when I felt really unlucky in that sense. All the airports were shut down, either were shut down actually or bombed. So you feel you're completely isolated from the world and you cannot travel, you cannot escape. My passport, this identity, this piece of paper, to me, it was a piece of paper that denies me access of anything in life, the ability to move freely, the ability to live. Nobody deserves this. So it's accumulated experience, started when I was young, and then it grew in me when the war started in Yemen.
Most of our listeners are lucky enough to have lucky passports. They live in Europe, they live in North America. Can you just explain to them on a practical level, what kind of difficulties have you faced having an unlucky passport? I mean, I imagine it's caused a lot of practical problems at airports, for example.
Having not lucky passport means that you will be questioned in the airports, where you come from. They question your visa. And if you're lucky, you might stay in the airport 5 hours. If you're not lucky, then 10 hours. And it happened. It happened to me. It happened to a lot of people. You know, when the war erupted in Yemen, most of the people who were evacuated first were the foreigners or the people who have the lucky passports. I'm literally talking about life to death situation, not privileges of having, you know, of being to travel and going to Paris or Disneyland. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about day-to-day life's difficulties and life and death situations.
How do you illustrate this issue visually? Tell us a little bit about some of the people that you've photographed for this project.
Visually, it's really difficult to capture something like that. But the way how I've done it, it was through participatory storytelling project. So it's not just about me. It's about, you know, the experiences of other people who share this feeling of being trapped. I started discussing this with different people who I encountered. And my participants came from different countries, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Sudan. And the way I've done it is taken their portraits behind the glass device to show the, you know, the idea of being literally invisible in the world, to show the idea that this is the way how we are being looked at behind, you know, customs screening in airports or when we are, you know, seek asylum in Europe or somewhere else. So, and then I thought I need to hear their voice. I need people to know their stories. So I requested my participants to send me letters capturing, you know, their feelings, their hopes, experiences, telling me their stories. So the project basically is so far is about portraiture and handwritten testimonies produced by people who share these experiences with me. And then when I came to Europe as a refugee myself, the project, you know, developed even more. And it was more about telling the stories of refugees in a different way, which means capturing the idea of displacement, the idea of integration in Europe. You know, now they moved from the unlucky borders. How does it feel for them to be in the lucky borders, you know, with that passport? You know, my message not to victimize refugees or my participants. I wanted to show them in a very dignified way. I want to show the struggle. I want to show the hope. I want to show the resilience. And at the same time, I want to show that these people are just people that you might encounter in the streets. Even my participants, they come from different backgrounds. They are writers, YouTubers, people who work on creative industry, people who are artists. They're like anyone else. So I want people to see them in that way and maybe question the visibility. They are like anyone else, but they're invisible because of their passports. So it's still a work in progress, to be honest. Every day a new idea comes into my head, either from talking to people or either from the experience itself. So the end result is making a book out of it. So I'm really keen to know what is it actually about.
We look forward to seeing that book when it's ready. I was wondering, do you think, so you're using photography as a medium, and I think a lot of people in everyday lives these days use social media, particularly Instagram, to kind of show a particular version of their lives. But are you fighting against this kind of rose-tinted version of people's lives that they're trying to portray on Instagram?
I love that Instagram is there. I love that people, you know, have access to social media everywhere. And even when I was in Yemen during the war, Instagram and Twitter was my channel to voice my opinion and to voice my thoughts and everything. But the role of photography here is different. I feel it's my responsibility to share these experiences of those who are not being able to share their experiences or to tell their feelings the way they want it to be told.
You wrote quite a powerful blog post about how a passport could be seen as a symbol of national pride, but in many cases like your own, it becomes a symbol of desperation. I was wondering, like, when you pick up your passport these days and you hold it in your hands, what do you feel?
Just recently, when I applied for the US visa and, you know, they told me, we really apologize, but you cannot apply. I felt not humiliated. It's a big word to say that I was humiliated, but I felt that I'm different, that I'm not like anyone else, that I'm misunderstood, misjudged. But somehow deep down, I feel like I'm just like anyone else in the street. Why I am different in that sense? I feel that I'm less than anyone else. But now when I pick it, I feel, sorry about the word, but I feel, oh my God, you're so useless. This is how I communicate with my passport.
So how can people see your work? Obviously, if they're in New York, they can go to this exhibition, but most of our listeners are European. Where can they find it?
I plan to release the book next year, 2019, sometime in the summer. And then my first step would be to show this book here in the Netherlands, where I conducted the project, where I took most of the photos. And I plan to also to show it at different refugee camps in the Netherlands. I want people, you know, the refugees themselves, to look at the book, to read their experiences. I'm so intrigued to see their reaction. And then from Netherlands, I am hopefully have plans to exhibit it other places, London, for example, Germany, and then maybe everywhere.
So if you happen to be in New York, go and check out the Open Society Foundation's exhibition that's on at the moment.
It's right by Carnegie Hall on the edge of Central Park, so it's very central. And it's running till July, so you've got ages and ages to see it.
I hope these photos get seen by so many people, because I think Thana's doing an amazing thing.
She is indeed.
When I listen to Thana talk about borders and passports and being like trapped in a war zone, it just makes me think, like, why are we even talking about the European project as this like sacred thing? Because actually, the European project is great if you're living and lucky enough to be born in Europe, but actually, we're still not letting people in who are stuck in war zones.
Right, yeah.
So that's a really grim thing to say.
I think something we should definitely be doing on this podcast is looking beyond Europe's borders.
Well, I'm sorry for bringing the mood down. Fortunately, our next topic is going in a completely different direction. We're going to call Bram Hilkins now. He has written a very interesting article about the growth of American hip-hop culture in Europe. He spent some time at Harvard's Hip Hop Archive and Research Institute. Did you ever know that hip hop is called like a language ideology? I really like that.
What does that mean?
I don't know, but I like the sound of it.
I don't know what it means, but it sounds very good.
It sounds really cool. Anyway, maybe he'll let us know. Let's give him a call.
I studied cultural history in the beautiful city of Utrecht. For my master program, I went to something that's called the Hip Hop Archive and Research Institute at Harvard University, which was one of the most intense experiences in my life. So I just decided to write an article about that, about my thoughts and experiences. Our Europe was a great platform. A friend of mine, he said they were looking for pitches, which happened to be about transatlanticism, which happens to be right up my alley, considering that I'm doing a lot with globalization and hip hop.
You grew up in an environment that was pretty far removed from the Bronx, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah,
Can you tell us briefly, like, how did you get into hip-hop in the first place?
Well, I was actually very late to the party. I, of course, dabbled a bit in hip-hop when I was in high school. Well, I was, by the way, very much into other forms of music, but hip-hop not too much until, I think, it's safe to say, Kendrick Lamar's Good Kid, Mad City in 2012. Which really sort of opened the floodgates, because I find that to be a super interesting narrative, really well told. I started getting really into contemporary hip hop, and I happen to have a great friend who's really into hip hop as well, and who has been before me. And we simply started making playlists and exchanging ideas. I was late, but not less passionate.
So hip-hop is obviously an American invention. It grew out of the Bronx in the 70s. Can you sketch out for us the story of how hip-hop came to Europe?
Especially since 1979, Rapper's Delight, Sugar Hill Gang, we've all heard this song. That's the first song to actually gain international recognition in Europe as well. And that sort of got the ball rolling more. People find hip-hop to be a very accurate tool, more or less, with which to express their realities, to express their narratives, which had previously largely been unheard. And so people in Europe start adapting to that and starting to take in these American ideas. And, well, they stay American in one way or the other, but they sort of transform it into something of their own. And especially in France, this is, of course, very big. And it's sort of a spark that initiated the United States, but then lit everything on fire in Europe as well.
So you mentioned French hip hop. I think probably most of our listeners are aware that there is quite a big French hip hop scene. But I was wondering, are there other non-English language hip-hop scenes that are quite popular across Europe?
That's kind of the thing that this article touches on as well. Because there is a very obvious language border, hip-hop is, of course, very language-driven, arguably more than a lot of other pop musics. But I must say that the Dutch hip-hop scene is rather big, but it doesn't really exceed Dutch borders, maybe Belgium, you know, and Flemish regions, but mostly it just stays within the borders of their own nationality, of the language that they're that the nation speaks. But you do see, as Jiggy J, who is a rapper and a label boss, some sort of veteran in the Dutch rap game, he told me that that is actually about to change because there seems to be more and more cooperation between different nations and different rappers who speak different languages. And they're starting to create songs together, and they start to exchange knowledge and ideas, and they're sort of blending right now, or they're on the verge of doing that. And I think that's a very interesting development, which we haven't really seen before.
I know in French hip-hop, people like MC Solar often talk about race and the experience of being black in France, which is obviously, there's quite a lot of overlap there with American hip-hop.
Yeah.
How is European hip-hop different from what you get on the other side of the Atlantic?
It's not too different. It's a slightly different urban landscape, but there's a lot of similarities. And I think that European hip-hop artists take a lot of comparison, and they do sort of adapt it with their own ethnical backgrounds and styles. You can hear that mostly in the music itself, in the beats and the things that they sample. But it's not very different. It's also very hard to pinpoint like one general style in hip-hop. Hip-hop has always been very eclectic, and that's the same in Europe. It sort of crystallizes. But then it's very hard to see this distinction, especially because a lot of great producers, like, for example, Drake's producers are really good at that. They're listening to any and all hip-hop that they can lay their hands on. And so they're taking that influence back and then putting it out, and then it becomes bigger than a lot of European hip-hop. And then the sound is sort of re-Americanized. The borders are very blurred in that spectrum. But the main difference, I would say, is very obvious, simply language. It seems that people love to express themselves in, their mother tongue. Who can blame them?
Bram's article is in the latest edition of Are We Europe. Just a little reminder that you can order their latest beautiful issue in print with a 15% discount code if you use the code EuropeansPod. Do it, it makes us look good.
Apparently some people did actually do that last week, and it made us look really powerful and influential as planned. So thank you very much to people who did that. And please, do it more.
Now it's time for Happy Ending. Our happy news this week comes from the Netherlands, where a Dutch zoo has for the first time ever had a successful hatching of the endangered brown North Island kiwi at the Avifauna Bird Zoo. The bird has been named Tuatahi, meaning the first in Maori, because it is the first bird to successfully hatch from an international breeding program for kiwis that spans across 16 zoos. They don't know the gender yet because they have to do like a DNA test on the feathers to work that out.
It's on the feathers?
Yeah.
I just didn't think that feathers like had DNA in them. I just thought they were like bits of dusters. Kind of thing.
You can get DNA from hair as well.
Oh.
You should not be on CSI.
Do you want to hear something else really ignorant? I didn't know that a kiwi was a bird. I thought it was a fruit and a word for someone, a person, a human from New Zealand.
Really?
I know, that's terrible, isn't it?
So, you know, the fruit is named after the bird.
What?
Yeah, and it happened in the 1960s. It was like a rebranding effort because people thought that the previous name of the fruit, which was the Chinese gooseberry, or gooseberry.
So catchy.
Can we say gooseberry or gooseberry?
Gooseberry.
Gooseberry, the Chinese gooseberry, was not a very appealing name for Western shoppers because of the connection with communist China.
So they called it a kiwi because it's sort of brown and circular.
Yeah.
That's amazing. They do look similar.
Yeah, and one of the reasons why kiwis are endangered is because they are flightless birds. So that might be why you didn't know it was a bird. No, you didn't even know it was an animal.
No.
But because they're flightless, it means they're a really easy target for predators. And they're one of the smallest flightless species that there are, poor little things.
They sound adorable, but also like it's amazing that they've managed to survive this long as a species, given they seem kind of hopeless, a bit like pandas, and that they wouldn't have survived if they weren't really cute. We wouldn't be helping them out. I'm not saying we shouldn't, because they do sound adorable, but a miraculous thing that they still exist, kiwis.
We should celebrate the birth of Tuatahi.
Well done, Tuatahi, and welcome. Next week, lovely listeners, I will be back in Paris.
I'll still be in Berlin, all alone.
A creepy doctor.
Yeah, I've now just got to like do it. Night after night, not night after night, I do it like 2 or 3 times a week, actually.
It's barely anything.
And I when know, you're on stage, you're mostly like just silent sitting in between to save my voice.
Oh, that's true. What are you going to do?
I want to go and see A Star Is Born.
What is that?
The new Lady Gaga remake of the most famous like film ever.
Oh, really?
You don't know about kiwis, you don't know about A Star Is Born. Katie, I don't know why I'm making a podcast with you.
I'm not very on it this week. I did manage to see Crazy Rich Asians finally, which is still not out in Paris, unbelievably. I had to go to London to see it. But I saw that was fun.
Why is it not out in Paris?
I don't know. There isn't as much interest or something. It's very sad.
That is very sad. I missed the boat actually with that one, but maybe I'll see it when it comes out on DVD.
Oh, DVD.
Do people buy DVDs anyway?
No, I don't think this laptop even has a slot for a DVD, so good luck with that one. You'll have to find an old person's house to go and watch it at.
Well, I'll come to your house then. Anyway, thank you for listening to another episode. We should not ever record episodes in the same room. Because we get distracted and we just chat to each other and we forget that we're actually making a podcast. But check us out on the Insta if you want to see photos of Katie and me gallivanting around Berlin together. We were getting our respective partners to take photos of us most of the weekend because we never see each other, so we needed to like save them up. And quite a lot of them do look like engagement photos. Apologies for that. We promise we are not in love. Only
you promised that.
Oh. Okay, we better go.
Have a great week.
Auf Wiedersehen.
Tschüss.